You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Wednesday, June 20th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, American historian and journalist. He's written for Rolling Stone. Well, just about every magazine. Author of Nixon Land, The Rise of a President, The Fracturing of America, and Before the Storm, Barry Goldwater and the Unmasking of the American Consensus. Rick Perlstein. Did I say his name twice? It's one of those days, folks. It's Wednesday. Also on the program today, Republicans still insane. Nobody wants to talk about Mitt Romney. Well, apparently not online anyways. Doesn't garner any hits. Also on the program today, NSA says, can't tell you how many people we're spying on in this country because that would infringe upon their privacy. Not making that up. Julian Assange seeking asylum in the Ecuador embassy in London. I think he's there now, hoping to get permanent asylum, I guess, in Ecuador, to prevent his extradition to Sweden, wherein a lot of people seem to think that he will be then extradited to the United States.
I believe they even offered him residency a few years ago, like they offered for him.
Yeah. We'll see if that still stands. And we'll get to that New York representative running for Senate in New York who is insistent on using children for his ridiculous campaign. This is actually sort of a funny story. And apparently, I got this out of BuzzFeed. Apparently, across the web, all these political outlets, all of these writers and whatnot are bemoaning the fact that no matter what they write about Mitt Romney, no one cares. No one goes and clicks on it. They're saying it at the Daily Caller. They're saying it at BuzzFeed. They're saying it at Atlantic.com. All across the board, BuzzFeed actually ran an experiment where that guy, Andrew Kaczynski, who digs up all the old videos, apparently, of candidates, created two sets of similar post-heavy posts focused on the early lives of Obama and of Mitt Romney. One focused on Obama's and Romney's childhoods, the other on Obama and Romney as young men. They were comparably promoted. All four posts appeared on the site's front page and pushed out to the social media sphere, I should say. But in both cases, the Obama-centric posts vastly outperformed those about Romney. This is actually not a bad thing for Mitt Romney. This whole campaign for Romney is basically to put him in the what are they calling it? The Mitness Protection Program. And over the past couple of weeks, Romney's actually gone out and campaigned, and apparently it's really hurt his polling. So Mitt Romney is going to try and stay indoors, write press releases, and hope that the economy catches up with President Obama. Later in the program, I will read that email that I spoke of yesterday that I received from a listener, again, taking up this issue of whether or not one should vote for President Obama. And again, I don't think who you vote for president is the most important thing as we go forward, but it's still relevant. It's an important conversation to have as it ties into how do we begin to create enough momentum in the country to push this country to the left and to pursue economic policies that are simply common sense. And to that end, we will go and talk to Rick Perlstein, who wrote about how the whole Wisconsin thing went down. Interesting take. We'll be right back after this. Back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is always a pleasure to welcome to this program Rick Perlstein, the author of Before the Storm, Barry Goldwater, and the Unmaking of the American Consensus, and the amazing Nixon Land, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America, which is not to imply that in any way Before the Storm was not amazing as well. It's just Nixon Land, I keep rereading parts of it.
Sammy, wait for volume 3.
Yeah, exactly.
That'll knock the socks off.
So, all right. So, Rick, you know, when all this was going down in Wisconsin, I was actually – I don't know why you stuck in my mind, and I think it was because I was aware that you were heading to Wisconsin from Chicago quite a bit in Madison back in the early part of 2011.
Yeah, I'm a Wisconsin native.
And that explains why you were traveling so much there. And so let's talk about this piece that you had in Rolling Stone online here. How Republicans cheat Democrats and Democrats cheat themselves. Let's just talk about at least some of the theories that you think are maybe secondary in terms of what happened in Wisconsin.
Sure. I mean, there was, of course, lots of Wednesday morning quarterbacking, as there's always going to be after an important election. And, you know, people are saying, what does this mean about what people think about public service unions, right? I mean, that's a good question. It's hard to answer, though, because last year when Ohio had a vote, even though it wasn't a recall vote, it was a referendum vote, they kind of struck while the iron was hot just a month or two after their awful law passed. The bad law was repealed overwhelmingly with 60%. So it's hard to say much about that. you know, we got the whole issue of how much money is getting spent in Citizens United. And, of course, in Wisconsin, we're talking about maybe it was the good guys being outspent 7-1 or maybe 10%, 10-1 or maybe 12-1. I mean, we'll never know. That's the whole point of this whole new funding regime. It's all secretive. But here's the point about that. I mean, they could spend 12 times as much as the unions and still only get, you know, really 52-53% of the vote. So it's kind of hard to understand how much money has to do with it. I just found myself kind of going back to first principles and saying this is an election that really underlines the entire structure of how we're doing politics right now in America in the year 2012, how Republicans do politics, how Democrats do politics, and where that leaves kind of us, you know, the kind of activist left that would like to see the Democrats act a certain way and never see them act a certain way. So should I elaborate about that?
Yes. In fact, that is exactly why I wanted you on the program.
Here I elaborate. So basically, if you guys will recall, there was a primary election for the Wisconsin Democrats. There were pretty good candidates, and one of them who was emerging as really the winner apparent was a woman named Kathleen Falk, who was a county executive in Madison and had the endorsement of all the unions, which is not morally irrelevant in a movement that only exists because of the courage and witness of unions, you know, Wisconsin Spring in 2011, right? So she's sailing to a victory with a very tough platform. She's going to go to the Congress or the legislature in Madison and say, unless you guys send me up a budget that repeals this law, I'll veto the budget and I'll shut down the state. That's a real hardball. That's the kind of thing you hear from Democrats. Well, lo and behold, what happens? 2 months before the election, Tom Barrett, the mayor of Milwaukee, a honorable and pleasant fellow, shows up in a fundraiser with Rahm Emanuel, $400 a plate, and enters the race the next day and glides to victory with all the establishment money, all the establishment endorsements, and suddenly the unions who started this thing become an also-ran. And the way Tom Barrett ran his race was very much in this kind of Obamaite, I'm going to be nice, I'm going to be conciliatory.
Well, before we get to
Walker divided the state. Well, let's get something that's just very specifically. And he said, the way I'm going to repeal the vote is call a special session of the legislature and try and get this thing repealed on a vote. So he didn't play hardball at all. In fact, he was the candidate of compromise.
All right. Well, wait a second. Before we get to even to how he approached the general recall, what happened in that primary? I mean, why was it that the union candidate got beat in the Democratic primary? I mean, presumably, right? This is where the energy was. These are the most activist Democrat. I mean, what happened there?
Well, I mean, it's an old story. I mean, it's hard to win once you're kind of rendered an insurgent. And it's actually what happens. I mean, this is a very important pattern, by the way. I mean, read the kind of stuff Howie Klein writes in on his blog about how the DCCC works. What happens is whenever there's a promising progressive candidate, sometimes running uncontested in the primary, one of these establishment comes along and always ends up running. And the way that happens is that's a signal when one of these establishment candidates runs, you know, say with someone like Rahm Emanuel kind of in their corner, that this is the guy that corporate Democrats are supposed to flood money to, and money was flooded to Tom Barrett. And Democrats, being good, loyal soldiers, say, well, we're all gathering behind this guy. And suddenly the progressive candidate becomes the divisive candidate. And I'm not, you know, quite sure about how it works on the ground. It's a little mysterious, actually. I mean, this is like kind of how, you know, a corporate cabal is one more way in which corporate cabals are kind of running our elections. But again and again and again and again, these primaries we see over the country, and there were a bunch of them, you know, two Tuesdays ago. It was almost kind of like a Super Tuesday for progressives. Progressives are losing to these corporate Democrats. It would be interesting to investigate more just what the the process is. But according to Howie Klein, it's really the signal that sent that this is the guy that you're supposed to send money to.
Right.
That kind of nails it for the Tom Barretts of the world.
I mean, in the case of Falk, I mean, I haven't heard, you know, out of Wisconsin, I heard that she wasn't a terribly great candidate. And one has to imagine, too, that, you know, 2 months out, if Barrett feels confident that he can jump in to this race and win, he must have seen some type of weakness there, at least in the context of the primary. But I think the larger point remains is that very often the there is, you know, and there wasn't, it wasn't like the gulf between Barrett and Falk was that big, right? I mean, on any issue beyond this one law. So, I mean, I think the
You know, and the only issue that, you know, was the reason the recall campaign existed in the first place.
Well,
yes. Repealing the law.
Yeah, so which I guess is a pretty big deal at that point.
And it's also I would push the difference theory, because if you have one candidate who's saying I'm in it to win it, in other words, who's willing to kind of do this hardball play, which kind of upsets the apple cart, and one who's like I'm going to you know, try and sit down and reason with an adversary who, you know, doesn't even consider you legitimate. And we know how, you know, the Scott Walkers of the world and Republicans think about unions as such. You know, they see themselves as Ronald Reagan, you know, breaking PATCO in 1981. That's a very different thing. I mean, there really are two different kinds of Democrats. There really are bold progressives and corporate Democrats. And it doesn't mean the corporate Democrats are necessarily always bad people. Or that Tom Barrett is a bad administrator of Milwaukee, or even that he would have been a bad governor.
Right.
But, I mean, look, we got a lot of work to do. We got to take back the country. And it's not going to happen with these milquetoast, I want a hug kind of Democrats.
Well, yeah. I mean, that seems to be more the issue, is that, you know, because I think Barrett, when he was in Congress, I mean, I don't know that you could really consider him a corporatist. He's a guy who voted against the repeal of Glass-Steagall. He's a guy who voted against, and, you know, probably because he's coming from Wisconsin, against most of the trade pacts that we don't like. But I think the interesting thing about your piece is that he clearly ran he ran on the idea of being non-confrontational, or as non-confrontational as one could, in the context of a recall, which, you know, is probably by definition the most confrontational type of election that could happen.
Yeah, isn't that kind of surreal, right? I mean, a very formative experience for me as a political journalist was going out to California late in 2003 and watching what the Republicans were doing to unseat a perfectly competent elected Democratic governor. And it was war for them. I mean, they were fighting for civilization. You know, it was Armageddon. And to come to Wisconsin and go to this rally with Bill Clinton, in which the whole message Bill Clinton gave was, well, Scott Walker started this civil war, and Tom Barrett is going to end this civil war, and that you only get things done when Democrats are and Republicans are willing to work together. Well, you know, that's all well and good, but it's not very realistic, both as a policy appeal or as a political appeal. And in fact, one of the examples Bill Clinton gave in this rally of you know, kind of corporations and politicians and Democrats and Republicans working together was, not to get too far into the weeds, but Rahm Emanuel's proposal in Chicago for a $7 billion infrastructure bank, which is a straight-up opaque corporate giveaway, which makes no sense at all. And so, you know, it just goes to show that so often when people talk about bipartisanship, they're just talking about, you know, kind of elite Republicans and elite Democrats getting together in a back room somewhere and conspiring against the public.
Right. I mean, do you think that, you know, when Clinton comes in there and is definitely less than fiery when he's campaigning for Barrett, and Barrett's tone, again, is sort of almost pre-conciliatory, and which, of course, is was one of the things that his supporters on the ground were pretty upset about, both, I think, literally.
Right.
Go, I mean, tell us about
that. I started my article with this video of this woman who turns out to be a school teacher, a union activist who actually walked from Milwaukee to Wisconsin to protest Act 10. So this is a person who's a hardcore activist. And at his election night party, he actually conceded while people were still voting in Milwaukee. And he said, you know, this woman said, you know, I'd really like to slap you for doing this. And he said, well, wouldn't you like to hug me instead? And reached down, and lo and behold, the woman slapped her. You know, so, I mean, this is kind of like a symbolic act. But what's happening here is, you know, he slapped first. I mean, you have these people who are doing things like walking across the state in order to bear prophetic witness for the forces of justice and goodness. And they're basically being told, you do not matter. They're basically being told the opposite of what Republican activists are told, which is that, you know, we're in this crusade together. And one of the things I talked about in my reporting was I compared two rallies I went to in Wisconsin. One was this Clinton rally that I talked about, but the other was a rally in Madison in which you had Tom Morello of Rage Against the Machine, you had Jackson Brown, you had this amazing, amazing rapper who you should have on, by the way, Brother Ali, brilliant guy, and you had this really kind of this Martin Luther King-like beloved community shouting their guts out and willing to fight. And it was very telling to me that Tom Barrett introduced Bill Clinton, but he basically just kind of did like a 30-second walkthrough of the crowd in the rally in Madison. It's obvious which side he's with. And how can you possibly win elections when you're throwing water on the people who are willing to knock on doors until they bleed if they only feel like the people who are there knocking on doors for believe in what they believe in?
I mean, do you think, I mean, are we looking at a problem? And you know, we can get to the other part. I mean, I think people are sort of familiar with the tactics that Republicans use, whether it's sort of just outright lying about jobs numbers in Walker's case, or jamming phone banks, or sending out text messages saying, well, if you sign the petition, you don't need to vote. All of those things.
Oh, come on, Sam. Both sides do it.
Yes, I'm sure. Just one side, not that one side, just so good at it, nobody hears about it. But I mean, do you think that we're dealing with, in terms of the Democrats, are we dealing with a simply a political style, or is this reflective of a policy agenda that just doesn't see the same stakes? Involved. I mean, you know, the Matt Stoller had a piece, you know, who is I think tends to be far more critical of the Democrats, not just on sort of style, but on substance. And he argues that whereas you, on some level, your argument was that Barrett was sort of assuming the post-partisan posture of Obama. The Stoller's arguing that, well, the problem is that Obama doesn't just have a post-partisan sort of style, or it's also a set of policies that are in some ways not aligned with the interests of the Democratic Party, or at least what was considered traditionally the Democratic Party, and that.
Well, I mean, these are.
Go ahead.
These are useful points for Matt to make, and they're useful to the extent at which they remind us that you know, we just have to see clearly that we're fighting for different policies than Barack Obama frequently is fighting for. You know, where Matt goes astray is he's, you know, extremely fatalistic, extremely nihilistic, and when, you know, something kind of doesn't go his way policy-wise, he suddenly, you know, tends to, you know, kind of come to the conclusion that everything is rigged, right? And, well, you know, if I were, you know, say a suffragist in the 1870s or abolitionist in the, you know, 1840s, and I saw someone saying that, you know, I'd want to slap them, because all it does is kind of enervate people for fights that really do take 50 or 100 years to win, right? So, yes, let's have some clarity about, you know, who the good guys are, who is on our side, who isn't, what the values are. But look, we're in a battle for the Democratic Party. It's not one thing. It's not another, you know. It is exactly who wins this battle, who determines what the Democratic Party is. And look at here in Chicago. I mean, we have, this is where I live now, we have an unbelievable battle going on between Rahm Emanuel, who's trying to kind of lengthen the school day without paying the teachers any more money, and he's absolutely been rocked on his heels by a strike vote of 90% of the teachers in the city. Not just 90% of the people who voted, but 90% of the people who teach in this city. That absolutely has him quivering, that absolutely has him suddenly sounding like a union activist and talking about how badly teachers need a raise. And what these teachers are doing in Chicago is they are reminding us that smart activism with smart demands backed by credible shows of force actually work, right? And if you just say, oh, well, you know, the game is rigged, and you're not alive to an actual historical change going on the ground, that's unilateral surrender, and I'm not going to do that.
You know, it's interesting because, I mean, this is a little weedy. I don't even know if you followed this at all, but one of the sort of side stories of what's going on in Chicago with these teachers, it came out of this story, I don't know if you read it, about change.org. Where change.org is a, well, the perception is out there that it's an organization that is a lefty sort of not-for-profit organization that turns out to actually be for-profit despite the .org, a consulting business in some ways that that allows for petitions to go up there and but also has paid petitions that sort of that get fed into other petitions, and they just were caught up in a firestorm over this issue, and ended up having to essentially fire as clients, I guess, or allow the contracts to expire with a Michelle Ray aligned mm-hmm. Group, Stand for Children, that is fighting essentially the Chicago teachers, and ostensibly for the kids, of course, and
for the children. Yeah.
But it's very exactly. But it's interesting to see sort of there's a broader understanding that, you know, we need to unify across sort of issue silos in many respects. And this is an argument that's been out there for some time, but it's interesting to see that. And also, I have to say that, you know, your perspective as a historian, when it comes to these type of issues, things are pretty bleak right now. At least in terms of those of us who have a leftist liberal perspective.
Think, Sam, you really think things are bleak? You know, is anyone getting beaten up in the streets? You know, are people being lynched? You know, people being thrown in jail for, giving speeches? You know, I think all the things that happened to our progressive four brothers and sisters, you know, in the 19th century and through most of the century happening, you want to hear bleak? You know, that's bleak, right? The bleak is, you know, a civil war where 650,000 Americans slaughter each other, right? Let's have a little bit of fortitude and a little bit of perspective here. You know, we're actually not in all that bad a shape when it comes to that.
I think
we're confused, well, you know, and we're not thinking straight, and a lot of that is because of Obama and people like Rahm Emanuel. But, you know, that's just why we need to kind of think together and reason together and get some clarity on these issues.
Well, no, I think your point's well taken. I think when I talk about bleak, I'm talking about the trend that it seems that from a liberal progressive perspective, there's almost a two-front war that's being waged or needs to be waged. And it makes it much harder when there is no sense of a national or leadership that champions these values. And there's really not a lot of at least obvious options to get from here to there. You know, sometimes when the issue is you've got guys with clubs who are coming down, you know, the battle lines are a little bit more clear in that moment. And the direction in which you fight is a little bit more clear. So maybe the word is frustrating or confusing. But give me your take on this. I mean, where is it simply just keep doing what we're doing? Is there something that strategically needs to change?
It's like I'm sitting here again in Chicago and in the middle of this, this fight between the teachers and Rahm Emanuel. Ordinary workers have this kind of authoritarian Democrat just completely, you know, quivering in a pile of jello just by doing the same thing that organizers always do, you know, kind of showing up and bodying forth with solidarity.
Do you think in Wisconsin?
Look at Ohio, man. It's like look at last year. They had a similar vote in Ohio, you know, against their own sort of Act 10 sort of anti-union bill. And, you know, our side won that fight by 60%. So I'd say we're kind of, you know, like even.
Well,
you know?
Yeah, I mean, but do you think
really
in Wisconsin –
because of the laws.
Do you think in Wisconsin the union should have done something different rather than pursue a purely electoral strategy? In other words, obviously it's easy to sort of to quarterback on Wednesday, as you say. But that the union movement needs to sort of take a different tact, I mean, and be more aggressive in terms of fighting rather than sort of channeling it into elections?
Yeah, it's hard for me to say. I mean, you know, a lot of unions are very kind of sclerotic and kind of go along to get along organizations too. In the Wednesday morning quarterback thing, yeah, maybe they should have waited and thrown all their resources into defeating Walker in 2014. And then, of course, there's, you know, the kind of half-full interpretation that, well, the Democrats, you know, won enough Senate seats in the election on Tuesday that they can block his agenda anyway, you know. I think just right now the real key for us is just to stay cool and try to think with clarity, you know.
I mean, let me rephrase what I think, you know, getting back to this bleakness thing. I think the difficult part is that at a time where we have Democratic control of the Senate, you know, with all the obstruction granted, there's a tremendous amount of unprecedented obstruction. And with a Democratic president, it seems that we as progressives are incredibly on the defensive. That we
incredibly what? I'm sorry, I didn't get that.
On the defensive. I mean, the fights that you're talking about that we're winning are all basically defensive fights. And we have staved off, different sort of, I guess, elements of a tide that seems to be, the headwinds, I guess, the expectations of the headwinds during this period were greatly underappreciated. And in fact, they're not really headwinds. They're almost tailwinds that we're fighting.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm glad you
could. Things are going to ebb. Things are going to flow. I've never quite verbalized this before, but the way progressives have it in 2012, it's not unlike what conservatives had it in 1955 when they thought that Eisenhower was going to be their guy, and he turned out to be, you know, completely devoted to preserving and expanding the New Deal, and you know, so this was really, but you know, look what things were like for conservatives then. I mean, that was the period when they really started organizing to take over the party. They got Barry Goldwater nominated as the candidate in 1964. And, of course, he was humiliated in 1964. But already by 1966, they're pretty much seizing the policy agenda. You know, the Great Society is in retreat. And, you know, they found a leader out of nowhere. You know, no one saw Ronald Reagan coming, right? So, you know, it looks pretty dark in a trench, you know. But suddenly you emerge, and you're moving in a direction faster than you ever imagined.
All right, let me turn just a little bit, because I think today or yesterday was the 40th anniversary of the Watergate break-in.
And yeah, the 20th, so it would have been the 17th. I'm not a big anniversary guy, but yeah.
I mean, it just it's in the news, and I saw an interesting story, and I'm curious about your take on this. I don't know if you've if you are familiar with this aspect of it, but the author Max Holland had a piece in the Daily Beast the other day about.
Oh, I didn't see it. What did he say?
Well, it was about Alan Pakula's papers, the director of All the President's Men, and I guess Max Holland also had
Alan Pakula's papers. Huh, interesting.
Yes, and Alan Pakula, of course, was the director of the
Carol Axiu and also One Flew. I mean. Yeah, that's like great stuff. Yeah.
And he sat down and interviewed all the players, you know, aside from just looking at the script, of course, that was written. But he sat down and interviewed all the players and came out with a notion of how essentially of how all of this went down in terms of the reporting that was sort of different than what ultimately was in the movie and different from the story that we've been led to believe. And Max Holland's written this book about Mark Felt, which sort of revises at least the Woodward Bernstein notion of why Mark Felt, who by all accounts was Deep Throat, why he did what he did, which, you know, I think we heard a little bit about, but...
Yeah, I'm looking at the Daily Beast thing now. I mean, and then you kind of, there's a related thing, which is that there's a new biography of Ben Bradley, who was the editor of the Washington Post, and that's really angered Ben Bradley and his noble and sophisticated wife, Sally Quinn. But one of the things that was pointed out in that book was, oh, the business in the parking garage might not have happened, and there. You know, might not really have been, a signal in the flower pot. This is what I have to say about that. I mean, Watergate is not about All the President's Men. It's not about Woodward and Bernstein. It's not about Alan Pakula, you know. I mean, this is kind of really just kind of, tertiary stuff. The basic story is, you know, more resonant than ever. And, you know, the anniversary I would look to and the real sort of powerful lesson we have to take from Watergate right now on the anniversary of the break-in is the Ford pardon. I mean, we have Glenn Greenwald pointing out that when Gerald Ford thought he could, you know, unite the country by pardoning Richard Nixon of all crimes that he might or might not have been guilty of, there really was just kind of like day one for open season for the 1% to basically get away with anything. I mean, suddenly we have each successive Republican regime, first Reagan's with the Marine Culture and then Bush with NSA and with Iraq and all the rest, operating in a accountability-free environment, because what Ford declared was that the presidency is too big to fail. And that if you're willing to basically stretch the bounds of propriety from the Oval Office, nothing is going to happen to you no matter what. And, you know, that's the case whether, Alan Pakula did what Shakespeare did and, right, you know, turned the raw materials of history into a nice, tidy story. You know?
Yeah, I mean, the real sort of interesting part about that is sort of just the implications, because Woodward went on to be, you know, sort of a huge voice of reporting in this country, and it sort of created a whole model of reporting. But leaving that aside, because your point is obviously more pertinent. Do you think, to a certain extent, the notion that the president really can't break the law? Do you think that's also sort of filtered down? I mean. President Obama. I mean, filtered down.
CEOs can't break the law now.
But I mean, I'm saying in terms of like, you know, President Obama, we have an unprecedented attack on whistleblowers. We have not nearly the transparency, in fact, just the opposite that we sort of anticipated or he claimed he would be pursuing.
We have a drone program that doesn't even exist.
Indeed.
Officially.
Exactly. I mean, that this is
embracing
all
this kind of Kafkaesque reality.
It seems to me, and I want to just get your take on this as a historian, that there has been this constant sort of drive to legalize that which we it's not only that you cannot really there's no accountability for the president, but there's also sort of seems to be to widen the berth of what is acceptable behavior by the president, and redefining what was once considered illegal legal. I mean, historically speaking,
that's the dominant direction of power in our time. But again, you know, sort of speaking on the terrain of centuries instead of decades, you know, these things move backwards and forwards too, you know. You know, people are at least beginning to recognize this. And the connections between, say, you know, the prerogatives of the 1% and the way the Supreme Court behaves and the way the president behaves and the way Jamie Dimon behaves and how these things all mix together. I mean, Hayes's book, Chris Hayes's book, Twilight Light of the Elites, connects all these things beautifully. So I'd say we're, you know, kind of analytically in a pretty good place. I mean, we're really beginning to see, you know, what the Gorgon is we're fighting and where its vulnerabilities may lie.
Not only did you tie it all together, but you also provided a perfect segue for tomorrow's program, where Chris Hayes will be on talking about his book, Twilight of the Elites.
Outstanding.
Rick, I appreciate your time today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great. Yes, Chicago listeners can hear me and Chris at the public library at 6 o'clock.
Oh, today?
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow. Fantastic. All right. Well, if I was in Chicago, I would definitely be there. Two of my favorite people to talk to. Rick, thanks so much for joining us.
Take care, Sam. Bye-bye.
All right, folks. We're going to take a break and head into the better half of the program. You can support this show by becoming a member. What are the benefits of membership? One, you wake up in the middle of the night and you think, like, all the horrible things you've done that day. To mitigate that, you can say, well, one of the good things I did is I supported a program that I listen to on a daily basis and appreciate its existence. And the other benefits of membership, of course, if you want, you get more programming and swag. And, well, that's about it. But that's a lot, folks. You can become a member today at majority.fm. We really do need your membership and your support. And you, of course, can pick up some coffee at justcoffee.coop, the majority.fm blend available there. 10% coupon code majority, you get 10% off. It's all fair trade, no exploitation. Your Amazon crap. Buy it at our Amazon link. We get a kickback. We got merch. Give us a review on iTunes. DonateYourAccount.com. Oh, remind me tomorrow to ask if anybody knows a good optometrist in New York City.
I think you just asked.
Yeah, I know, but I don't know if anybody listens at this point in the program. I mean, if any of the non-members listen, the members do. I think for some people, this is their favorite part of the show. Just like this, when I make this change, flip over to the better half of the program.
How can you turn this off?
Exactly. This is where people do their 3x or 4x speed on their podcast.
No, this is when people get ready to click the rewind button to listen to today's podcast all over again, twice.
There you go. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920. I will read this email in the better half of the program. Make a pretty good argument.
We also have a bunch of great sound.
We have a bunch of great sound today. We have those children singing that Lee Greenwood song. We have an ad by Joe the Plumber.
Weirdest ad I've ever seen.
No, it's not. You've seen Herman Cain ads.
That's
but it's
true.
Definitely like
but I think
a Herman Cain-esque ad.
I think Herman Cain went for the weird ads, though. I think this one is just...
No, he's going for the weird
ad. You think
ad.
He's going for the weird?
Definitely. What else? Do we have any other sound?
We also have a racist radio host in, what was it, Texas, I believe?
No, I don't even know if she's a radio host. Maybe. But we seem to have that every day now. That's what the rest of the campaign is going to be. It's just going to be Obama making promises that we're all skeptical about, and then right-wingers calling him racist names. Should be fun. See you in the better half.
How could you fast-forward through this part?